So glad to have the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm a longtime fan, so it's a real pleasure. First off, let me share with our listeners that you have won a 1984 Hugo Award for your sci-fi novella Cascade Point and are a prolific science fiction writer, including your Black Collar and Cobra series. But many of your fans know you as the author of the most beloved and influential novels in the Star Wars expanded universe, including a trilogy and duology featuring fantastic original characters. I want to start our discussion, since we have the pleasure of being in an audio format, of doing a reverse vocabulary quiz. First, one of the smartest, most thorough-thinking villains the Empire ever had to offer, an alien in a system of power that had a xenophobic legacy. Can you tell us about this senior captain to Grand Admiral's full name and a little bit about him?
Okay, he's known as Thrawn. That is his core name. His full name is Mithranuru Odo.
Mithranuru Odo.
Correct. The core name is taken from the center of that, and that's how Chiss would know each other, those who don't need to use the formal full name.
Mm-hmm.
And Thrawn chose to allow the Empire and everyone else to use his core name because, frankly, humans don't pronounce Chiss words all that well.
Okay, so we are a few humans who are working on the Chiss words. So tell us a little bit about Admiral Thrawn and the Chiss.
Thrawn is a brilliant tactician, kind of the epitome of all the great military geniuses throughout history all rolled into one. He anticipates his enemies, moves, has ways of countering them. He is probably the best commander that the Empire has at the time. He has the ability to inspire loyalty in his troops, whereas Darth Vader and the Emperor inspired fear.
Mm-hmm.
When I was first asked to write these books or offer the original Thrawn trilogy, part of my goal was to make a story that was not what George Lucas had already done, but what felt like Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was coming up with a new type of villain. And I thought a villain who can inspire loyalty is far more dangerous because even when he's not in the room, his people will fight and die for him.
Wow. Continuing our quiz, your next my most beloved character, the Emperor's Hand, a formidable femme fatale who starts as a morally ambiguous, force-sensitive, and embarks on a long journey of discovering her values and place in the world. We'll come back to her later, but tell us her name.
Her name is Mara Jade.
Tell us a little bit about Mara Jade.
Well, she was, as you said, the Emperor's Hand. She was a special agent the Emperor used during the height of the Imperial Dynasty. She was out of the usual chain of command. She could go everywhere. She could pretty much do anything. He mostly used her as a tool against traitors, people, Imperial officers or governors who were embezzling or doing things against the Empire. The rebellion was mostly the focus of Vader, but she would do kind of the internal affairs type of thing. She was Force-sensitive. She could use the Force. She was not a Jedi or a Sith, though.
Mm-hmm.
I postulated that, as we saw in the prequels, the Sith go in twos, and there's always a tension between the master and the learner, the student, because there's always a power issue. What the Emperor had done with Mara was to make her believe that she was doing everything right, that she was serving the cause of justice and honesty and all of that. So she was not a Sith. Of course, she was certainly not a Jedi. She was an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked for quite a while until Luke Skywalker and his friends, you know, rather unfriendly-like, blew up the Death Star out from under him.
Okay, so we've talked about Mara Jade. What about her sometime smuggler boss?
Helen Card. He is kind of where I thought Han Solo might have been if he hadn't dropped into that cantina on Tatooine for a drink and met Obi-Wan and Luke. Card is a smuggler. He's an information broker, but he also has a code of ethics. Just like Han Solo, he would probably deny it, but you see all through, even through Han's growth arc, character arc, you see his loyalty. He's loyal to Chewbacca. He's loyal to his friends. And Card is much the same way. He will smuggle. He will do things illegal. But he has a core of values that he won't cross.
In terms of characters, tell us a little bit about Card's new lieutenant after Mara from the Shadow Guard.
Shada Ducal. Yes, she came in the Hand of Thrawn duology, Spectre of the Past and Vision of the Future. She was part of a people who had been devastated by interplanetary warfare. She had always grown up believing that her people were slaughtered and nobody had cared. The Shadow Guard were sort of their mercenary type, the people who hired themselves out to get the money to rebuild their world. And later she starts wondering or discovering it may not have been as simple as she was told, that maybe her people were in fact aggressors.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, some of her moral direction is now skewed, and she wound up working with Card and eventually becoming part of his organization.
Well, and I want to get back to that changes of moral direction later, but let's rapid fire through a few more words. Creatures that feature prominently in your first Thrawn trilogy by creating bubbles where the Force doesn't exist.
Isalamiri, the plural Isalamir.
I've always wanted to know how to say that. Okay, so the leopard-type predators who are drawn to the Force.
Those are Vornskirt.
Okay, and the planet they originate from.
Mercure.
The race of incredible ninja-like creatures who are duped into subservience to the Empire.
The Naugri.
Final pronunciation issue, the slight differentiation in the clone names. Do you want to demonstrate that?
All right. Evil clone more insane than really evil, mm-hmm. in the Thrawn trilogy was cloned off of Jorus Sabaoth. The clone is now Jorus Sabaoth. There's a second vowel in the name to designate the clone. The reason I did that was I knew I was going to have a battle near the end of the Thrawn trilogy between Luke and a clone of him, Luuk. In a movie or television show, you can put them in different clothing and keep track of them.
Mm-hmm.
In a book, you can't do that. So I needed some visual cue to let people know who was who.
Right. So it's a visual clue in language.
Exactly.
So to me, you've created a cast of characters with such depth, humor, and dimension, and many of them have been women or minorities. I was reflecting that you created a character like Mara Jade, who in some ways fits a trope of a dark past redeemed, but she's a woman. And in the stories and comics where her imperial roots are explored, she both undermines and solidifies the Empire as this totalitarian evil system. Tell me what inspired you for that character, because this was published before Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Xena Warrior Princess. What drew you to a female character to foil Luke Skywalker, in a sense, in the original Thrawn trilogy?
Well, again, I wanted to do something different than what George Lucas had already done. But looking at the characters, we had a nice foil for Han in Leia. So I thought it would be nice to have something similar for Luke. He is the straight-up farm boy Jedi. How about somebody who is, as you say, a bit morally ambiguous, just as powerful as he is, and, you know, just as a nice addition, hates his guts.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew where she was going to be going. I knew where she was coming from. And yet, I think even back then, and I do more of this in the two book Choices of One and Allegiance, you can see that she is fighting for the right side being the Empire, as far as she knows. She's fighting against people who are stealing from the Empire. She's fighting against people who are corrupt. And if you start from the premise the Empire is good, it just needs this stuff rooted out, which is what she's been carefully trained to believe, then she is on the side of right and justice. So she has never, through that time, believed she was part of an evil Empire. The Empire is, at its core, good. It can be made better by rooting out the corruption. So not only is her character somewhat morally ambiguous, what she believes has been designed to be morally ambiguous. It makes her a complex and interesting character.
Yes. And I want to revisit that in a sense. You know, you do this in a similar way with the Hand of Judgment, a rogue stormtrooper unit in the same books you just mentioned, Allegiance and Choices of One. What drew you to that similar undermining ideas about good and evil, right and wrong?
Again, I mean, that's at the core of all of human experience is good and evil, right and wrong, etc. And much though the movies make it look like the Empire is this monolithic evil thing trying to crush rebellion, in any army, even the Nazis, you had good men, good soldiers who were fighting for what they thought was right. And that's what I was trying to do with the five stormtroopers of the Hand of Judgment, that they signed up to protect people and to bring order and peace to the galaxy. And when they find out they're part of a machine that's doing just the opposite, when the opportunity arises, they leave, even though on one level they all want to just kind of go off and disappear someplace. The very moral imperative that got them to sign up for the stormtroopers in the first place, that of helping people, keeps coming out. Well, here's some people who need help. We're stormtroopers. We got equipment. Let's go help them. They're an interesting group. I would really like to work more with them.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And then they join Thrawn, which leaves that as an open-ended story possibility.
Which also is reflected in then a book that I wrote previously, but takes place afterwards, Survivor's Quest, where the 501st has been reestablished in Thrawn's Empire of the Hand, and Luke and Mara run into some of the members there who wind up being very good allies.
The vision that you have in your own expanded universe is so sprawling. Did you have that from the beginning when you started that original trilogy? Did you have this whole arc in your mind or not? Because
No. You have to understand that when Heir to the Empire came out, nobody even knew if Star Wars was popular, if anybody cared about Star Wars. It had been eight years since the last movie. The Star Wars fans were quiet, mainly because they didn't have anything to grab onto, we know now. But there was no indication whether the Thrawn trilogy would be the first of a series or whether it would be three standalone books that would show that there's no point making any more Star Wars stuff because nobody cares anymore. So, no, I did not have all of this set up in my mind. The fun thing about doing a novel or a trilogy or something like that is there are always little places you can attach other things. Like a jigsaw puzzle or in homage to the recent box office hit, like Legos. You can always add new stuff on and add to what you've already made. And you just find the spots. Here's a logical thing to do. Here is a logical, Thrawn will set up this out in the Empire of the Hand. This is the reason he set this up. This is the reason you got this. Okay, I've mentioned the 501st and Survivor's Quest. How could that have come about? Well, how about the stormtroopers from Allegiance and Choices of One? So you start seeing where things will fit in, backfilling, going off in new directions, and then backfilling with those. It's kind of like I started in a corner of the canvas, and I can still add stuff in.
Going back to the questions of moral ambiguity we were discussing a second ago, I've read that you're discussing that you understand the desire for realism in the deaths of certain characters or in the way that stories progress, but that to you, the genre is the classic triumph of good guys over the bad guys. Do you see that genre as more important in the complicated world we live in a post-9/11, post-Edward Snowden world, or do you think it becomes more irrelevant?
For me, the purpose of fiction, science fiction, et cetera, the primary purpose is entertainment. It's good to have moral decisions we made, it's good to have role models, it's good to have philosophical questions, but the primary purpose is entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, entertaining is when the good guys win. And I've always thought Star Wars is a genre where the good guys win with minimal bloodshed. You're losing rebels and TIE fighters and everything all the time, but none of the main characters in the movies are getting killed. Qui-Gon, and even then the death is necessary to bring Obi-Wan into the fore in Phantom Menace. But my take was always, and remember a lot of these were written before the prequels,
mm-hmm.
My take was that if Lucas was going for major or semi-major characters dying, Lando or Wedge would not have made it out of that second Death Star. They would have died there. The fact that they didn't, and the fact that Han didn't die, even though apparently Harrison Ford wanted him to, tells me that this is going to be our good versus evil, the good guys win, and we can all go home with a smile on our faces.
Yeah.
That's what I've tried to recreate in my books, that feel.
Well, you are incredibly graceful about the fact that your characters aren't truly yours in any legal sense. They belong to the Star Wars franchise, and you have no input on their future adventures or, spoiler alert, lack thereof. But, I mean, go ahead and spoil us with Timothy Zahn's alternate expanded universe. How would you see the whole story ending, broadly speaking?
How would I see the story ending? Well, there are people who have speculated up until Disney bought Lucasfilm and the new movies were announced. There was a question of how would you kill off the big three, Han, Luke, and Leia.
Mm-hmm.
And my take is you don't have to kill them off. You can do the Sherlock Holmes route. He just retired and went off into beekeeping. So you can take them off stage without having them die on camera, as it were. That would be the way I would do it. We'd pick up a new generation. We would, in fact, I'm hoping that's what the movies do, that they pick up with the next generation, Han, Luke, and Leia, the elder statesman type, were giving advice and watching others go out in the X-Wings or whatever to battle the whatever the new evil is that's coming up. But that's what I would go. I would go with the next generation, with our heroes still alive and kicking, maybe semi-retired, individual characters. Oh, I've got probably plans for all of them, but at the moment the books, as far as I know, are more or less on hold while they decide what they're doing with expanded universe, if ever, if anything.
Yeah, many fans see your universe as at least as definitive, if not more so, even than George Lucas, and are worried about the new films, despite J.J. Abrams' reputation. The dismay many felt at the prequels is hard to overstate. So what advice, beyond what you just said, would you give the crew working on 7, 8, and 9?
Oh, I would not presume to give them any advice unless, of course, they asked for it. I would say look at the classic trilogy. See what the elements are that made those such a wonderful hit that survives and is rewatched over and over again 30 years later. Look for those elements. Don't copy what's worth in there, but look for the elements. The heroism, the love, the friendship, the sacrifice, the good versus evil, camaraderie, humor. You've got to have humor to make you really identify with the characters. And take those elements, make some characters that we can all relate to, throw in a bunch of cool space battles and lightsabers, and go for it.
Speaking of lightsabers and space battles, you know, the writing a space battle must be really hard, but you have a background in physics. You have a BA and an MS in physics, and you're a sci-fi writer. Want to tell us that story?
Why I'm not doing physics right now?
Or how it influences theory. Your work and why you're not doing it right now?
The short answer is I was working on my doctorate. I had sold a couple of stories. I was working on writing science fiction as a hobby. And my advisor died suddenly of a heart attack. My project was not working. It was never going to work. There was a fatal flaw. It's a mathematical thing. I was told I could start with a new project from scratch. It would take me another 2 years. Minimum to get my doctorate. I'd already been in the department for 6 years, 6.5 years, and I discovered while working on a new project for a semester that I couldn't work on a project and write at the same time. I just didn't have the mental energy for it. So December of 1979, I decided I'm going to quit, try writing full-time for a year, and see if I can make a go of it. And I like to think that the fields of writing and physics have both benefited from that decision.
So tell us a little bit about your original fiction.
What you want to know, I do everything from semi-fantasy in The Green and the Gray to military with the Cobras. I have a fair amount of military political stuff. I've done several series, Black Collars, Conquerors trilogy. I did a young adult series called Dragon Back, which is a lot of fun to do. And at the moment, I'm working on a series of books collaborating with David Weber, set in his Honor Harrington universe. But they're set about 350 years before Honor Harrington. So we're looking at the early days of the Star Kingdom of Manticore, and a lot of filling in a lot of background that David never really bothered with. We're getting to play with all of that. So that's been a lot of fun.
That sounds incredible. What makes you decide what project to take on next?
Something that looks interesting, something that would be fun, that has some promise. Certain things are always, you know, if they asked me tomorrow to do another Star Wars book, I would say, tell me what era and what you want, and probably the answer is yes. Otherwise, it's just, I need to come up with a new idea or a new series. What have I got in my brain I can develop or start something new? It's mostly a matter of whatever captures my attention sounds like it'll be fun. If it's not fun, it's way too much work.
Well, I've gone about this interview totally backwards, but we're talking to Timothy Zahn because PensaCon is the first inaugural PensaCon, sci-fi, fantasy, horror, all kinds of genres convention for the first time in Pensacola, Florida. Tell us, from your experience on the convention circuit, what we should be expecting and what you're looking forward to.
Expect a lot of fun, a lot of guests. There should be interesting panels, a lot of actors, writers, comic book people. It's a great place to meet some of your favorite genre types, have a chance to chat, buy a picture, you get a book autographed, ask questions at panels. Just basically a lot of fun hanging out with people who like the same sort of stuff that you do.
Have you ever been to this area before, Pensacola, Florida?
I don't think I've been to Pensacola. I've been to a couple of other places along the Gulf Coast for conventions, but I think Pensacola, this is my first time in Pensacola.
Well, we are super excited to have you. Anything you're looking forward to in particular? Are you going to hit up the beach?
Oh, I doubt I'll have time. Most of the time I get to do the convention and come home. I'm sure I'll see the beach at some point. Looking forward to having a great time and meeting a lot of people.
Awesome. I've got a few extra questions, if you don't mind, and we'll work them in somewhere. Is there anyone that you look forward to seeing on the convention circuit? Do you know anyone who's coming to PensaCon that we should look out for?
I would have to pull up the list, but Peter Mayhew we know him quite well, him and his wife, Angie, and we've run into many conventions. My wife has pulled up a list. Let's see, who else we got here? I've met Daniel Logan. Billy D. Williams is there. I've met him briefly. Mike Barron is interesting. He is the writer who, back in the early 90s, Dark Horse Comics did an adaptation of the Thrawn trilogy. And Mike Barron is the guy who kind of boiled down a novel into a six-part comic. So I'm looking forward to, you know, to saying hello to him, getting some autographs on my copies of the collected Dark Horse comic adaptations. He did a really great job of boiling down the story. So a lot of other guests coming, the Walking Dead folk. We've got Battlestar Galactica, the original Galactica, and probably a lot of people in Doctor Who costumes.
Speaking of costumes, tell us about your experience, or what's the best way to cosplay Mara Jade, Paleon, Thrawn? What have you seen, and what, you know, makes you laugh or makes you think, or you're like, they really got it?
I have seen quite a few people over the years, mostly Mara, but more and more Thrawns are showing up too. It's a little trickier because you've got the blue makeup to put on, but I'm just impressed at how good, how excited, you know, how clearly interested and excited the cosplayers are. And it's an immense kick for me to see one of my characters walking around. And whenever I see somebody in one of the costumes, I will always go up and get my picture taken with them. Just, you've got a record of it all.
I want to see that photo collection. That sounds incredible.
It's a lot of fun. It's surrealistic on some level. Again, remember when I was writing this, nobody knew whether these books were even going to sell. I remember sitting around one day trying to figure out how many libraries, public libraries there are in the U.S. If they all buy two copies, how many can we sell? Can we earn out this book? And as we all know, that the Star Wars fans were just simmering there below the surface and just boiled up as soon as there was something for them to grab onto. And they've been going strong ever since. So it's a kick and very humbling to see that something I have done has captured people's imaginations. Not just they read and enjoy the books, but they also want a costume and cosplay. And everyone I've seen has done a great job. The Thrawns have the right attitude. The Maras have the right attitude. It's just very fun to watch.
I seriously thought about cosplaying Talon Card, but I couldn't figure out what would be distinctive about him. Other than bringing my own Vornskers.
Well, that's part of the problem is with books, you get covers and you may have a comic book adaptation, but there's not a lot of costume in a movie. You can't do a Jedi robe because you've seen Obi-Wan wearing them all over the place. It's hard to find a costume that will be distinctive. You sure you wouldn't rather do Chateau Ducal?
That might be my next try. Okay, I've got one more question, and then I'll wrap up. But my one last question actually was in regard, to prepare to talk to you, I haven't read Star Wars novels in a long time, but I read Allegiance and Choices of One over the weekend. And one of the things that struck me was that there were no droids. Do you dislike writing the droids?
I don't dislike them when there is a reason for them. The problem is if you've got a story that already has plenty of characters and there's no place for the droids. Now, the droids had pivotal roles in the Thrawn trilogy, but in Allegiance and Choices of One, there just really isn't a spot for them to do anything useful. And I don't want characters just stand around, you know, filling up the scenery without having something to do. That goes for human aliens as well as droids. So, no, I don't dislike the droids. It's just in these particular stories, there wasn't a part for them.
Timothy Zahn has said no to droid tokenism, is what I'm hearing.
Yes, and human tokenism and alien tokenism. If they're going to be in my book, they've got to pull their weight. Let's just put it that way. Hi, this is Timothy Zahn, Star Wars author of Scoundrels and Heir to the Empire, and you're listening to WUWF, Public Media.